lots of us grew up with the idea that out gay life on the street, extravagant, happy, wonderful gay life is a very recent invention. We find it hard to believe that glorious creatures like Stella were around a long time ago. People often use the phrase, gosh, the world has really changed. And that's a phrase that I think should be banned. The world doesn't just change. All the changes that we've seen in this country are changes that we made happen.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappell. Russian activists arrested where neo-Nazis march free, U.S. Methodist ministers defy marriage policy ahead of equality vote, and Stella steals the show at Brighton. Those stories and more this week because you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm John Dyer V.
And I'm Jason Proctor.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBT communities around the world for the week ending May 7th, 2016.
Russian police officers welcomed a contingent of neo-Nazis to this week's annual St. Petersburg Labor Day parade. 19 out LGBT people, on the other hand, were violently arrested for trying to march in the May 3rd parade under their own banner. The city's legislative assembly allowed Slavic Power Northwest to march under the banner for the unity of Slavs and the white race. There were no incidents. The LGBT rights group Coming Out was given the okay to march as long as participants didn't display rainbow flags or other self-identifying material for the safety of other marchers. Doing so would violate the nation's so-called gay propaganda law, which, with the full support of President Vladimir Putin, bans any public support for LGBT rights whenever and wherever minors could be present. Coming Out proudly marched under its own banner anyway, which prompted the arrests. Video shot on the scene shows activists being roughed up and dragged to police vans. Charges facing 19 of them range from violating the gay propaganda law to resisting arrest and hooliganism. One young woman who requested anonymity told reporters that it's disgusting that a neo-Nazi group, who if they had their way would want us put in camps or something, is allowed to march freely. We know which side the police are with now.
Elsewhere, a North Carolina pastor and bishop have risked their careers by violating United Methodist Church law and officiating the marriage of a gay couple. Retired Bishop Melvin Talbert co-officiated with Reverend Val Rosenquist at the wedding of Jim Wilborn and John Romano at First United Methodist Church in Charlotte. Several other faith leaders were present to lend their support. According to the UMC group Reconciling Ministries Network, the ceremony could jeopardize the pastoral credentials of Reverend Rosenquist. Current church policy forbids clergy from presiding at the weddings of same-gender couples and warns that no ceremony can take place in a UMC sanctuary. The pastor and bishop could each be reprimanded or even defrocked. Other Methodist clergy who've officiated marriages of same-gender couples have been similarly disciplined. Bishop Talbert, who was arrested with Martin Luther King Jr. in the Atlanta sit-ins in 1960, called the wedding an equal rights protest, telling BuzzFeed that it was an act of civil disobedience. The only difference is we are giving it another name and calling it biblical obedience. With about 7 million members, the United Methodist Church is America's largest mainline Protestant Christian denomination. Its general conference is scheduled to begin in Portland, Oregon on May 10th. Delegates rejected attempts in 2008 and again in 2012 to repeal the church's ban on clergy officiating at the weddings of same-gender couples. Reconciling Ministries Network and other pro-equality advocates hope the U.S. Supreme Court's June 2015 marriage equality ruling will make this year's third effort the charm.
In this week's developments involving North Carolina and its offensively discriminatory HB2, the U.S. Department of Justice officially warned the Tar Heel State's dominant Republican Party that they stand to lose millions of federal dollars unless the law is repealed. HB2 bans local governments from protecting LGBT people from discrimination or from even passing a minimum wage that surpasses the state standard. HB2 is best known, however, as a bathroom bill because it also requires trans people to use sex-segregated public facilities based on their birth gender, not the gender with which they identify. U.S. Deputy Assistant Attorney General Vanita Gupta issued separate letters to state officials and to North Carolina's public university system this week, warning that HB 2 conflicts with Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and Title IX of the Education Amendments of 1972. Both documents ban sex discrimination, which courts and the Obama administration have determined to include discrimination based on gender identity. The letter told state officials to begin a repeal process by Monday, May 9th. North Carolina and its public colleges could lose millions of dollars in federal aid if the law isn't overturned. House Speaker Tim Moore told reporters on May 5th that the Justice Department demands were unreasonable and politically motivated.
This fight's about a duly passed law for the state of North Carolina and about the overreach of the Obama Justice Department. We will take no action by Monday. That deadline will come and go. You know, we don't ever want to lose any money, but we're not going to get bullied by the Obama administration to take action prior to Monday's date. That's not how this works.
Vastly outnumbered minority Democrats in the legislature reminded anyone who would listen that HB 2 was debated, passed, and signed into law in one single day in late March. Governor Pat McCrory, who steadfastly defended the law, told Raleigh TV station WNCN late this week that the state would comply with the federal edict. However, he has no power to force lawmakers to take action.
The last U.S. state adoptions ban finally fell this week. Mississippi officials had until May 3rd to file an appeal of a federal court ruling that found the state law banning same-gender couples from adopting children to be unconstitutional. Ruling that the Supreme Court's marriage equality ruling included adoption rights, U.S. District Court Judge Daniel P. Jordan III issued a preliminary injunction earlier this year that blocked the Mississippi Department of Human Services from enforcing the ban. State officials' failure to continue to defend the law means that it's effectively dead.
Backlash against Mississippi's so-called religious freedom law continues. HB 1523, passed by the overwhelming Republican majority in the state legislature and proudly signed by Governor Phil Bryant, allows employees in both the private and public sectors to refuse service to anyone they don't like based on sincerely held religious belief or moral conviction. LGBT people are the less than subtle targets. A growing number of business leaders and entertainers have condemned the law. Hundreds of protesters gathered outside the governor's mansion in Jackson on May 2nd to demand repeal. Representatives from the Human Rights Campaign, the NAACP, the ACLU of Mississippi, the Southern Poverty Law Center, and Planned Parenthood joined in.
The Kansas State Legislature adjourned on May 2nd without taking any action on two anti-transgender bathroom bills that would have rewarded students who reported violations of the law. The bills barred trans students in public schools, including state colleges and universities, from using the sex-segregated facilities that correspond with their gender identity, including restrooms, showers, and locker rooms. The bills offered $2,500 in damages to any aggrieved student who witnessed a trans student using the prohibited facilities.
What critics call the nation's most terrifying anti-trans ordinance was passed unanimously in late April by the Oxford, Alabama City Council and then repealed by a vote of 3-2 just a few days later. The ordinance imposed a fine of $500 and up to 6 months in jail for the misdemeanor crime of using a public restroom that didn't match the gender listed on a person's birth certificate. Opponents led by the Southern Poverty Law Center and the ACLU, which specifically threatened the lawsuit, told the City Council on May 4th that the ordinance also threatened the loss of substantial federal funding because it violated national anti-discrimination laws. Satisfied SPLC staff attorney Shaneer Ezzi told reporters that nobody should be criminalized for simply using the restroom. In a related story, rabidly homophobic Alabama Chief Justice Roy Moore has been suspended and faces possible removal from office. A state commission on May 6th charged him with 6 counts of ethics violations surrounding his obstructive actions against marriage equality following the Supreme Court's June 2015 ruling. He claimed that the ruling didn't apply in his state and ordered Alabama probate judges not to issue marriage licenses to same-gender couples.
And finally, national political correspondent David Weigel noted in the May 3rd edition of the Washington Post that transgender people won a somewhat queer electoral victory this week. Far-right Republican presidential wannabe Senator Ted Cruz of Texas tried to make his last stand in the Indiana state primary a referendum on trans rights. He warned about predatory men invading women's and girls' bathrooms and railed up and down the state against rival Donald Trump for not joining his crusade. Cruz then lost Indiana in a landslide and ceded the Republican nomination to Trump. Marla Kiesling of the National Center for Transgender Equality said that Senator Cruz's desperate attempt at using transgender people to scare people and drum up support clearly didn't work. Hopefully, politicians will leave us out of their rhetoric unless they have something constructive to say. That's News Wrap for the week ending May 7th, 2016. Produced by Steve Pride, written by Greg Gordon, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Jason Proctor.
And I'm John Dyer V.
The world premiere of British queer arts activist Neil Bartlett's newest work is bound to be one of the biggest attractions at this year's Brighton Fringe Festival. Bartlett first used the story of the gender-fluid 19th century performer Stella in a piece for a 1983 festival, but this time, Stella takes center stage. Radio Reverb's Out in Brighton host Kathy Caton shared her exclusive interview with the OBE recipient writer-director.
She's only a bird in a gilded cage, a beautiful sight to see. You may think she's happy and free from care. She's not, though she seems to be.
Neil, why Stella and why this key figure who's at the heart of the piece?
Stella's been a fixture and fitting in my life for a very long time. I first discovered Stella and her story way back in 1983, boys and girls. There was a fantastic thing in London called September in the Pink. And September in the Pink was the first London-wide lesbian and gay arts festival. There had been other queer arts festivals, but not one that stretched right across London, which was a big controversial thing back in the day in 1983. There were angry letters from the Evening Standard and so on and so on. And I was one of the people who helped organise the festival. And I also created my own piece of work for the festival. And it was a piece about queer history. It had three episodes, three acts, if you like. The first was about gay men's lives in London in the 18th century, and the third piece was about our current lives. The middle section was about the 19th century, and while I was researching the piece, and also while I was writing my first book, which was a queer history book, I discovered this extraordinary story of Stella, aka Ernest Bolton. And I think because lots of us grew up with the idea that out gay life, gay life on the street, proud gay life, extravagant, happy, wonderful gay life is a very recent invention, we find it hard to believe that glorious creatures like Stella were around a long time ago. So, Stella's story. To save any time or trouble, I'll just call her she. I always think of Stella as she. Stella's born in 1848, respectable lower middle class circumstances, born in Tottenham, North London. Her family sent her to work in a bank, and that doesn't really work out because already by the time she's 18, 19, Stella and her friends are running around the West End of London, sometimes dressed in what I would call high femme, high queen style, lots of makeup. Very tight trousers, very loud colours, very low-cut shirt collars, and hanging around the streets, generally causing trouble in the fashionable West End, Piccadilly especially, and the Strand. Sometimes, even worse, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, Stella and her friends would go out dressed as ladies. What they meant by ladies exactly varies depending on where they were. If they were on the Strand, Piccadilly, then they were ladies in the sense of sex workers. They were out to pick up men and either get bought dinner or something slightly more graphic. If they were on the other side of Piccadilly, Burlington Arcade, they were masquerading as middle class ladies with a capital L. And Stella and her friends could pass. In other words, they could choose whether to walk down the street as women or if they wanted to reveal themselves as being what we would call queens, what they would call sodomites or Marianne's, they could do that. Then 1869 all goes a bit pear-shaped. She goes out with her friend Fanny to the Strand Theatre, and at the end of the evening they decide they need to titivate slightly, so they go into the ladies' loo to repair their makeup. And they get rumbled, and outside the theatre they're arrested. Very shortly afterwards they're both in the dock at the Old Bailey, and they're on front page of every national newspaper in the country. Being outed as a cross-dressing sodomite in 1869 was a dangerous thing. That was a disaster. Fortunately, she had a brilliant defence lawyer who, whether by luck or good judgment, hit on a brilliant argument. The charge was conspiracy to commit a felony, which was code for being a bugger, being a sodomite. And their defence counsel brilliantly argued, if you were a sodomite, surely the last thing in the world you would do would be to run up and down the Strand wearing cherry silk, lots of slap, a wig, false tits, high heels, etc., because that would draw attention to the fact that you were a queen. And the jury, bless them, fell for it. And so Stella was acquitted. She fainted dramatically, possibly deliberately, I think, at the moment the not guilty verdict was declared. In a way, that's the least interesting part of her extraordinary story. What then happens is what really, I think, makes her a game changer in our sense of ourselves as queer people. What would you do if you'd been outed as a cross-dressing sodomite and you were on the front page? Surely you would tone down your act. Surely you would disappear. Not a bit of it. She changes her name, goes to America, and a few months later is having a rather successful career as a bit part actress and drag queen on Broadway, if you please. She goes to New York and does rather well for someone of really very little talent. She had apparently a pretty voice, a fantastic wardrobe, and she looked gorgeous. Of course, the American career couldn't last forever. The publicity that she generated by being so notorious began to fade, and also she began to lose her looks. Does she give up? No, she doesn't. She comes back to this country. She changes her name once again, and she tours in the absolute fag end of British music hall and vaudeville for another 26 years. That's extraordinary. You know, to be a flamboyant queen when you're young and gorgeous is one thing. 25 years later, when you're playing second-rate gigs on the Isle of Man or in the smallest theatre in town in Scunthorpe or wherever else she was reduced to touring. For me, that's real heroism. Stella died in 1904. We know she was living in Somerstown, and you don't end up in rented accommodation in Somerstown if life is going well. And she died in the London hospital. She must have died as Ernest Bolton. It's very difficult to go into a hospital now as anything except your birth gender. That's a difficult thing to achieve. And in 1904, that was an impossible thing to do. So she must have made that last journey to the hospital as Ernest, not as Stella.
My name's Kathy Caton, and I'm talking to the award-winning playwright, director and performer Neil Bartlett. At the moment, in terms of the fight for trans visibility, the growth of queer and life beyond binary, where do you think Stella would have identified?
Well, Stella, of course, lived before hormones and before gender reassignment surgery. There is a completely uncorroborated story which came from her mother's evidence in the trial at the Old Bailey that Stella liked to dress up as a little girl when he was a little boy. We don't know if that's true. And some people have seized on that and said, ah, you see, Stella was trans. The facts are that when she was working in the bank, I think she would have passed as a normal, in inverted commas, young man. When she was queening around the West End in effeminate male dress, she would have self-identified probably as a Marianne, which was the word used in London more often than the word queen, for someone who was on the borderline between being an out-and-out sodomite and a sex worker. Possibly she would have called herself a sodomite. When she was in drag, sometimes she appeared as a drag queen. She toured in amateur and professional theatricals, and sometimes the playbills and the reviews say the marvellous female impersonator Mr. Ernest Bolton as Stella, and sometimes they say the marvellous Stella Clinton. And the reason why they use the surname Clinton is Stella had a boyfriend, Arthur Pelham Clinton, in fact Lord Arthur Pelham Clinton. Her boyfriend, dear reader, was a Tory MP. And Arthur and Stella appear together on the stage and always in little dramatic skits where Arthur would play the straight man, the man, and Stella would play the lady. So sometimes a lady, sometimes a drag queen, sometimes a lady with a capital L, sometimes with a small L. When she appeared in the dock at the Old Bailey, possibly her greatest triumph of impersonation, she grew a moustache to convince people, presumably, that she was a real man. So, as you can see, I'm dancing right round your question and refusing to say, was Stella trans in the modern sense of the word, of someone who fully identifies as leaving behind one gender and becoming another? We don't know. All we do know is she travelled through many gender identities, sometimes in the course of a single day. And of course, I'm an artist. I'm not in the business of saying we really need to categorise this historical figure, because that will prove what. I think we need to revel in the imaginative possibilities that this glimpse of history might give us. Of course, I'm thrilled that the conversation has moved on from where it was when I first put Stella on the stage back in 1983. There seem to be so many more possibilities about how we as queer people can live. The question for me is, how do you live? How do you want to walk down the street?
Sing if you're glad to be gay. Sing if you're happy.
When you talk about early 80s, height of Section 28, definite lesbian and gay identities, fighting. And you've been active in the queer arts world for some years.
Yeah, don't be shy.
For decades.
I've been making my living as an out queer artist since 1982, and I'm really happy about that.
And the huge amount that we have travelled in that time. How does it feel to, when you look back on that journey from the early 80s to where we stand now?
Well, it feels very tiring, obviously. I hope that where we've got to always encourages us to ask for more. I think we're living in wonderful times and also in very dangerous times. I think there is a real and present danger that we're being sold the idea that gay history is over in this country. We've now arrived at diversity, tolerance, acceptance, and we can all just relax and enjoy our little gay lives and everybody loves us. And I think that's horseshit. It certainly is true that life is a lot safer than it used to be. You know, my partner and I, he's just had knee replacement surgery, so he has to lean on my arm when we're walking down the street. And he's been up and about for 2 months now. So we've been walking arm in arm down lots of streets in Brighton and in Worthing and in all different parts of London. We haven't had any trouble. Cut back to 1983, which was just before he and I met. if you were out courting arm in arm in 1983 through to for the next decade, you were going to get shouted at, spat at, or punched. You know, so I'm really glad that that has changed. But for me, as a queer man of that generation, the real demands that we were making, oh, I'm going to sound very old-fashioned now. Do I care? For me, gay liberation and feminism were the same thing. I learnt how to fight for my freedom from one, women, and two, other queens. And where is that struggle in this country? Do you know any women? Oh, it's fantastic. You know, really, feminism is over because we've got everything we ever wanted. And what about all the other appalling forms of inequality and prejudice which are stifling this country? And so the larger demands of gay liberation, which were not, can you leave me in peace? I just want to go to the gym, the disco, and then to bed with my boyfriend. But can you not acknowledge that queer lives are a glimpse of the world running differently? I will now press the button to hear the sound effect, which is Neil climbing down off his soapbox. And one more thing while I'm up on my box. People often use the phrase, gosh, the world has really changed in the last few decades. And that's a phrase that I think should be banned. The world doesn't just change. The world gets changed. We didn't get to this place because someone turned round and said, hey, queer people, would it be nice for you if we stopped discriminating against you? All the changes that we've seen in this country from top to bottom are changes that we made happen. We've made them happen incredibly fast and in a way that will be really difficult to unpick in the future. We're really good at fighting for change, and I want us to use what we've learned about how to do that to go further.
We'd like to thank Kathy Caton for sharing her exclusive Out in Brighton interview with the brilliant Neil Bartlett. The month-long Brighton Fringe Festival starts this week, and Stella plays Friday and Saturday, May 27th and 28th, at the Theatre Royal Brighton. You can find the playwright online at Neil, that's Neil-Bartlett.com. Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. This week, Jason Proctor, John Dyer V, and Kathy Caton contributed program material, with thanks as always to Steve Pride. Harry Anthony and the Tom Robinson Band performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Yavanna Foundation, the Estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and to you, our listener supporters, for making this program possible. You'll find more information about the show, the crew, a video teaser for our must-have LGBT History from Outlaws to In-Laws CD, and more at thiswayout.org. Email tworadio@aol.com or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Lucia Chappell. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on 5GFM Kadena, South Australia, KBRP Bisbee, Arizona, WBCR Great Barrington, Massachusetts, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Now y'all stay tuned.